Velkommen, så vil jeg lige appellere endnu en gang til især nede i venstre hjørne, at I trækker indenfor, hvis I har behov for at tale sammen, eller også så sætter jeg ned og lytter på, hvad Melissa har at sige her om et øjeblik. Tak. Og så vil jeg lige om et øjeblik give ordet til vores speaker i dag, som er kommet helt over fra New York for at dele noget styrke, håb og erfaring med os, og dele lidt om sin historie og de her trin her. I want to give you a big warm welcome, Melissa, and say thank you for coming all the way from New York and sharing your experience, strength and hope with us. So I will give you the word. Big welcome.
Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa, and I'm an addict. I'm Alhingi, right? It's the best I could do with my Danish. I did that yesterday, and I'm getting better. And I'm already overwhelmed by your reception. It blows my mind that me, this dope fiend from the Lower East Side of Manhattan, who sat in jails and track marks all over my arms and slash marks on my wrists, that you want to give me so much love just because I say I'm an addict. We only get that in Narcotics Anonymous. Just so you know. It means a lot to me. I used to have a big problem when I was using. I couldn't tell you what I really wanted. And really, I found out through Narcotics Anonymous, I really need love. And I got no problem saying it, that I need love, and I also need to give love. It's really important for me to do that. I want to thank the Copenhagen area for asking me to come. I think it's monumental that, you know, no matter how long you clean, you have that little thing of self-esteem. Like, what the hell am I going to say? Like, you want to fly me all the way over here. And when Jack called and asked me to speak, hello. When Jack called and asked me to speak, I was picturing, it's so funny in my mind, I'm thinking, Denmark, everybody's clean cut and healthy. No one looks like addicts, right? Everybody's like, you know, home of the Vikings. So Jack calls me and says, you know, when we're talking, how am I going to know you at the airport? I said, well, don't let me not to describe me. I'm pretty ordinary looking. I said, my husband's got really long blonde hair. He says, okay. He says, and I'll be with the guy with the tattoo on his neck. And I knew I was in good hands. I said, all right, he's a freak. He's my kind of people. And it's really funny. No matter where you go in Narcotics Anonymous, that's who we are. These are my people. This is my family. I have to tell you, I have a biological family, but you know who I tell? You know, I'm going to tell my story, but the people that I tell first, everything, good stuff, bad stuff, I have to tell you, it's my addict friends in Narcotics Anonymous. And I wouldn't change it, like I was sharing last night, one day, one minute. These are my best friends, the best people that I know. Addicts are pretty incredible people. We're super sensitive, super kind, super loving, super scheming when we need to be. Now, if you think about all the different schemes that we've all put together, you know, it's like pretty incredible. But we're smart people. We're smart people. You know, I want to talk about my life, and I want to talk about steps and all the parts that make up the Narcotics Anonymous program, because it's like all spokes in a wheel, you know, spokes in a wheel. And if one of those spokes is missing, the wheel starts to get weak on one side. So if you're missing service, or if you're missing a sponsor, or if you don't make meetings, or if you don't make phone calls, or if you don't raise your hand, if any of those spokes are missing, your wheel's going to start to get weak on one side. And I was sharing last night, I see a lot of people in H&I meetings, and this is what they say, I stopped making meetings, you know, whatever their spoke that they took out of their program. When I was a kid, they used to tell us, this was a big thing in the 1960s. If you smoke pot, you're going to end up shooting heroin. That's the big thing that they used to tell us. No one knew back then that was called the progression of the disease of addiction. No one even knew there was a such thing as a disease of addiction. So they used to have to come, like addicts come to school to us to talk, to try and scare us. And the difference between an addict and a normal person says, wow, that's really terrifying. I better listen. An addict, I was like, wow, that sounds really fucking cool. They gave us like scary books to read. There was a book called Go Ask Alice. It was about this girl who starts taking acid and she gets in with a cool crowd. I wanted that. There was a movie called Panic in Needle Park. There's a place in Manhattan called Needle Park. It's this little triangle where everybody's shot dope. And Al Pacino was in the movie and everybody's like nodding out. I was attracted to this movie. That should have been my first hint that I was not like everybody else on planet Earth. Thank God. I'm all right with being an addict. Thank God. You know something? People pay gurus. They climb mountains. They chant. They do the sun. You know, they all kinds of stuff. I'm not saying anything's wrong with any of those things. People pay big bucks to get what we got. You know we got why we got? Because I shot too much heroin. Because I smoked too much crack. Because I took too many pills. Because I stood on the methadone program line. So thank God I did those things because it's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. Beyond my wildest dreams. And only because I was doing this. So in the 1960s, I remember my first drug, and I always say I'm an addict. I'm not telling anybody how to identify themselves. I don't say I'm an addict and an alcoholic or anything like that. And before somebody was reading, and it was in Danish, so I was trying to follow along, they said that before we came to NA, many of us viewed alcohol separately, but we cannot afford to be confused about this. And yet I always meet someone who wants to be confused about this. If I put alcohol over here, and I put drugs, and I say drugs and alcohol, I know drugs are bad. I know I can't shoot dope, but maybe one day I can go have a Tuborg, or whatever your beer is over here, Carlsberg, right? I can go have something like that. So I say that alcohol is a drug. Because if I identify myself as anything else, that's like saying I'm addicted to all vegetables and broccoli. So my program teaches me it's all one drug. The only difference is alcohol is a legal drug. That's the only difference is. And I got to tell you, man, your country can fucking drink. Boy, oh boy, you're some drinking. Me and my husband going on the subway like, man, these people can drink. Serious drinking. And coming down here to the convention, I saw plenty of future members of Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, we're laughing. But it's sad. It's sad because they don't even know. They don't even know what we got in here. They're standing outside and they're running around like maniacs. They don't even know what we got. And all they got to do is walk in the door and we'll do the rest for them. We'll take over, give us a hug. We'll do it for you, but they don't know yet. So the first drug I remember drinking, I would go down to my parents' basement. I would like screw the top off the alcohol, drink some alcohol. And I remember putting sugar in it because it tasted so nasty. But the reason I was drinking alcohol wasn't to like taste good or anything. It was to get a buzz immediately. And that's the difference between a straight person, we call them earthlings, and a normal person. The difference between an earthling and me is I always used to get his, and I'm sorry, I'm gonna curse. And you know what? I have to curse because I have a friend, Khalees, and he says my using was in gee golly gee. It was like, motherfucker, that was my using. So I'm gonna talk like that, so you have to excuse me. So when I was drinking, I was using to get fucked up. From the very beginning, I remember the first time I went with my teenage friends, we all went into a park or something, we drank beer, and they literally came home to my house and poured me out onto my lawn. I was almost unconscious. That was the first time I used. The first time I used to get obliterated, and I always used to get obliterated, and I didn't care what I used. I wanted more. I didn't even ask what it was sometimes. There would be lines laid out. Oh, what is that? You know, you do that, and then you ask later. It's cat shit. You're gonna, you know, whatever. Fine, what will it do to me, you know? And that's an addict. That's an addict's thinking. So I remember doing that, and of course, my disease progressed. And a lot of people talk about this, that one high wasn't good enough anymore. You got to progress to the next high, you know? And the next high was smoking a joint. And the next high was taking acid. And the next high was taking pills. And I remember feeling, as a kid, very different then. There's a saying that we have, that I felt like I was on the outside looking in to the rest of the world. Except me being an addict, I wasn't even the outside looking in. I was on the outside looking the other way. I didn't even know to look in. It was like, we have another expression, that the world was a black suit and I was a pair of brown shoes. I didn't match. I didn't fit in. I didn't jive with the rest of the earth. So my using progressed. And I remember, and it's not really important what I used. There's a little story that I tell these three addicts in Narcotics Anonymous. And we don't care what you use, by the way. These three addicts in Narcotics Anonymous are all talking, what's the worst drug out there? Addict number one says, heroin is the worst drug out there. I steal my mother's pocketbook for $10. I don't even get high anymore. The best I can get is not sick. Heroin's the worst drug out there. Addict number two says, please. Alcohol's the worst drug out there. I wake up with wet brain. I got the DTs in the morning. My liver is sticking out. Alcohol's the worst drug out there. Addict number three says, please. Crack is the worst drug out there. I spend a half hour on the floor looking for anything this big and white. And if it's this big and white, I'm smoking it, no matter what the hell it is. I was sitting at the dinner table with my husband, and his head started to look this big and white, and I wanted to... Crack is the worst drug out there. So they're all arguing, oh, I had it worse than you. No, I had it worse than you. So they all, like, go up to this old-timer Narcotics Anonymous. They say, what's the worst drug out there? Come on, I suffered worse than you. No, you suffered worse than me. No, they're arguing. He says, the worst drug out there is the one that brought you in here. So we all use different drugs. We all use different drugs. So I just tell my story and tell you what drugs I was using just because it's part of my story, not to say that anything else by that. So I was heavily addicted to pills at this point in my life. And I remember going over to my girlfriend's house, and it was one of those, you know, typical addict things, like her and her boyfriend had a screaming fight at 2 a.m., and, you know, and they called me, why don't you come over? And, like, you don't even blink an eye at that kind of, okay, I'll come over at 2 a.m. And they had these lines laid out. And like I said, Melissa never asked what it was. Melissa only chose the best for herself, always, right? So I bend over and I snort it. And I found my love for the next many, many years, and that was heroin. And there were people shooting up around me, and I was disgusted by them. I'll never do that. Yeah, we know. It's like, I'll never do that. And let's flash forward. Now I have track marks on my arms. I have hepatitis. I'm sleeping in abandoned buildings. Because we say never say never. There's that invisible line. You know, I really believe that we're taught right from wrong. And some of us had hellacious, had really bad childhoods, and we were given some bad direction in our lives. But I really believe there's some kind of inner thing that tells us what's cool and what's not cool, what's right, what's not right. And the bottom line is, I had lines that I would draw for myself, like I wouldn't steal. You know, that one went away. That was the first one to go. I would never prostitute myself. Each one, and here I am, this like kid from a, you know, middle class family. Now I'm sleeping on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in abandoned buildings, and my disease progressed. Okay, needless to say, I'm running around, and now I'm on what we call liquid handcuffs. We call this liquid handcuffs the methadone program. So we call liquid handcuffs because you ain't getting out. So one of the great things about Narcotics Anonymous is we say that we suffer from the disease of addiction. We don't talk about any specific substance. And the disease of addiction for me is threefold. It's physical. That means when I use, something different happens to me than happens to regular people. I have a friend that says he tells people he's allergic. And they say, what happens? He says, I break out in jail. And I break out in poverty. So something different happens to me. The mental aspect of my disease is that I think differently. I'm obsessive. I'm compulsive of all natures. And the spiritual part of my disease is my total self-centeredness. I don't even consider you. You don't even exist in my world. That's my thinking. And I'm on the Lower East Side, and I'm homeless. And now I'm on the methadone program. And I was always very addicted. You know, in Narcotics Anonymous, it's a great thing that we come here to learn about our disease of addiction as far as drugs, but you find out a whole lot more. And I found out that I also loved the idea of being in love. Okay. Yeah, we know that one, right? So I was always chasing men, you know, like, you know, and I'm not saying I don't love men. I love men today, but I love my husband. Actually, it's not men. I love my husband. I should say that. I have one man. But I remember being on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and this was one of those lines in the sand that I said I wouldn't do. And I'm on the methadone program, and I bump into this guy, and I think he's cute, and he thinks I'm cute. You know, like, addicts are funny. You have a five-minute conversation. The next thing, you're engaged. You know, addicts are like that, right? So I meet him, and we talk for a little bit. And he says to me, now he lives in a different state than me, this guy. And he says, do you want to come home with me? Now this is the best that I can come up with for myself, a total stranger that I meet on the street. I say, okay, but here's my only requirement. And this is how little I thought of my body, myself. And trust me, I slept with many men and I thought nothing. I could separate my body and just do what I had to do to get the next one. So I say to him, you know, sure, I'll go home with you. I said, but my only request is that you get me back to Manhattan in time to get to the methadone program. That was the best I could come up with for myself. So I go home with this guy to New Jersey, right? And I wake up and I'm in an abandoned construction site. That's the best I could do for myself. And you know, when I wrote my fourth step, I was really pissed off at men. But I have to tell you, I raised my hand and I volunteered for every single thing I ever did to myself. He didn't do anything that I did not ask him to do. So I wake up at this abandoned construction site, and now I'm figuring, how the hell am I going to get back to Manhattan? How the hell am I going to do this? So I start walking. I hop the subway, I get on the subway, and I'm still dressed in my, you know, everybody remembers this, it's the next morning, and you're dressed in your nighttime clothes from the day before. That doesn't look too weird, right? So I'm on the subway, and I'm dressed like in a dress at 9 a.m. with high heels. So I go down to the Lower East Side, which is, I mean, I walked so much. In active addiction, it seemed like I walked all fucking day. I just walked all over the place. I had this big coat, and I walked all, and I was tired, and I kept walking. And I walked to Cop, and then I walked uptown, and I said, I'm going to go home. And I didn't go home, and I walked back town because I needed to get more. Oh, I better go uptown. I walked back uptown. I walked all day, and I never went anyplace. So I go back to Manhattan, and now I go to my methadone program. I walk all the way up there, and you know what? It's closed. Now, you know that fear when you run out of that last one? That fear that grips your belly, no matter what your drug of choice is. Now I'm petrified because it's Saturday, and not only do I not get my Saturday dose, I don't get my Sunday dose. I'm petrified. I walk back down to Lower East Side. We're talking 70 New York blocks. Walk back down to Lower East Side, and I see this guy. And here's how my decision to prostitute myself came. So simple. It wasn't even a difficult decision. I see him. I said, do you have anything? He says, yes, I do. And he says, and you know what I want. And ladies and gentlemen, I did not say, well, I'll take $10 for my trade for you. I didn't even think that much of myself. I took it straight up for a bag of dope. And when I was doing what I had to do for that straight up bag of dope, I did not think to myself, what's become of me? What's happened to my soul? What's happened to my dreams? What's happened to my desires? The only thing I could think of was, this fucking bag of heroin better not be a beat bag. It better not be a bad bag. Because that was my God, that was my higher power, that was my love of my life. And let me tell you, I tried lots of things to stop using. You know, I sang for a living. And so I went on the road with this band, and I was in far out places in the United States singing. And so what did I do? There's always a way to use. I would call my friends in New York and Federal Express my heroin to me. And they have a commercial, Federal Express, when it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight. And that's what I had to have. I had to have my heroin. I tried school. I went to school to study Spanish. And I wanted to be, this is the ego of the addict, I wanted to be an interpreter for the United Nations. It's like, right, it's funny, right? I couldn't want to be like a secretary or who spoke Spanish, you know, and I want to work for the United Nations. So when you're shooting heroin, it's hard to attend college. So needless to say, I never went to school. And the only Spanish I ended up speaking was, we have a saying, bajando. Bajando in Spanish means, hurry up, the police are coming down the block. You better leave the abandoned building. Like I said, I tried men. And I remember being in mental institutions, mind you. Mental institutions. Now, the funny thing is my track marks have pretty much healed up on my arms, but I still have slash marks on my wrists. They have never gone away. I still have them because I tried to take the most precious gift. Now, I'm locked up in a psych ward for trying to kill myself. This is probably the best time to meet the love of my life, when you've just attempted suicide. So when you're in psych wards or mental institutions or treatment, you always end up hooking up with somebody. That's like addicts, you know, like you find your true love. So there was a guy in the mental institution, and he had fallen. He was there because he did too much coke, and he fell in a puddle of water in the wintertime, and his face froze. This was the guy for me. So we hook up, and you know how that goes. A week later, 1 week later, we're like yelling at each other about, you stole my heroin, you know. So no matter what I tried, the bottom line is what I'm trying to say is, though, no matter what I tried, I always brought me along. See, I believe that I have a hole in my gut, a hole in my soul. And I don't know if you've ever tried to make a puzzle. You know when you make a puzzle and you got that one piece, you can't figure out where it goes, and so you kind of cheat and you shove one piece into the puzzle, and you know it doesn't go there, but you shove it in anyway. What eventually happens to the puzzle? It buckles up, right? Because it doesn't go there, and the piece pops out. I tried to shove a lot of stuff into that hole. Many different things. Like I said, men. I tried to still, like, shove food in there. I take my credit cards. I go crazy with it, you know? There's lots of things I try to shove in that hole to this day. And you know the only thing that works in that hole is the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. It's a God-shaped hole. It's the only thing that's going to fill it. And I had to come here to find that out. Needless to say, all the things, like I said, that I tried didn't work. And I ended up, like I said, sleeping in abandoned buildings and prostituting myself. I'm on the methadone program. And thank God for cocaine, because it was my bottom. I was shooting a lot of cocaine, and I was really, really fucking crazy. I mean, I was really crazy. I thought I was nuts when I was doing other things, but I was really crazy. I was paranoid, mice running all over me, vicious, vindictive, stole everything from my family that wasn't nailed down. My family, I have a story that one time I went to visit my sister, and I took a train to go see her, and I said, I'll be at, you know, this train, and I'll be in at 11:30, and it was Easter Sunday. I was going to see them for Easter. And I got off the train, and I was waiting for her, and I went into the bathroom, right? And I came out, and she said, Melissa, I called her, because I waited an hour. She never showed up. I said, Stephanie, where are you? She said, I came to the train station, and I went into the bathroom, and I saw your shoes underneath the bathroom door. I know what you were doing. I lived in the bathroom. That was my little world. I had a bedroom and the bathroom and everybody else's bathroom. And some of the most humiliating things I could remember. You know, I've done some pretty bad things, but the most humiliating things is literally being taken and thrown out of people's houses. Because they were like, they say de gato in Spanish, which means dirty dope fiend. De gato sucio, dirty dope fiend. Taken and thrown out of other people who were just as dirty as I was, but they were throwing me out. Having a gun held to my head. Because I was accused of stealing somebody's watch. Now, I did steal the watch, but that was another story. I felt it was very unjustified to have the gun held to my head. And it sounds funny now, but let me tell you something. When you have three pissed off dealers holding a gun to your head for an hour, and they're going, shoot her, shoot her. And do you think I stopped using? And what they did was they pulled the trigger at the end of the night, and it was empty, and they all had a big laugh at my expense. But again, I signed up for all that stuff. Everything I did to myself. So now I'm in another institution, another mental institution, because I tried to kill myself again. See, I didn't like living the way I was living. And I don't know if any of you can identify with this. Did you ever, we call them, the things that you shoot up with your needle, we call them works. Have you ever thrown your works away, or you throw your pipe away? And you really mean it. You're determined. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to, you know, this is like fucking midnight and you're high. So you mean it when you're high. I'm going to do all this great stuff, and you throw all that stuff away. And the next morning, you're digging like a dog in the garbage can. Like a dog in the garbage can. And that fear grips your belly again. So there were many times I really didn't want to use. But now I didn't know how to stop using, because that's what happens with the disease of addiction. It takes on its own momentum. And they say like a snowball rolling downhill. I couldn't stop. So I ended up in another psych ward because I tried to kill myself again. For me, existence became painful. It just wasn't worth it for me to live. And the funny thing was, I was trying to kill myself with gas, you know, the oven. And they made these fancy new stoves and ovens that every time I blew out the pile of light, they'd light back up. I was like, oh, you're against me too. Come on. God wouldn't even let me kill myself. But you know what? It wasn't my time. Not my time. I really believe, and I'm going to talk about something that happened to me in my recovery, that I have a purpose for being here. We see a lot of people who don't make it, who OD, who die of AIDS, and we say, well, why them and not me? I have a purpose here. There's something I need to do. It may never be revealed to me what I need to be doing here, but there's something I need to do to balance out all the shit that I did in my life. So I was in treatment. Now, I had been in treatment before, and Narcotics Anonymous, hospitals, institutions, my heroes of service, came up every Thursday night, and they told us, you know what, you never have to use again. And I never believed them, so I went out and I used. And now here I am back in treatment. There was a difference. I wanted to be there. And you know that feeling when you want to be there, when you're like determined. And I started making Narcotics Anonymous meetings. But the funny thing is I'm still so willful. I still did it my way. So I sat in the back of the meeting. I did not sit up front. I took all the women's inventory. I didn't want to be close with you. Why would I want to look in the mirror when it was so painful to know myself? So I like flirted with the men. Ah, you're such a good chairperson. You know, bullshit, you know. So, and, you know, the men ate it up, you know, whatever I told them. You know, it was stupid. So I don't mean men are stupid. I really don't mean that, because men do it to women too, and we eat it up too. So, we say that you tell me what I want to hear, not what I need to hear. And so I sat at the back, and I didn't have a sponsor. I want to tell you how I got my Narcotics Anonymous sponsor, because Melissa always learns a really thick way, right? I had about 10 months clean. And at this point, I just recently got married. I know, do the math. I know, 10 months got married. You know how they say for that first year, don't get into relationship? I was not only going to get in a relationship, I was going to get married. I was going to top the suggestion. I wasn't even going to listen. So now I'm 10 months and I'm married. And I'm married to another addict in Narcotics Anonymous. He was clean about 2 years more than I was. And so I'm on parole. No, I'm on probation, excuse me. Because I was in a treatment facility, and even though I liked the treatment facility, I left because I wanted to do it the NA way. So I call up my probation officer and I say, guess what? I'm doing really good in society. I got a job. I got married. I got 10 months clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And she says, well, there's a warrant out for your arrest. Now, we all know, what was I doing? What was I doing? I was making amends. I was trying to make right my amends, right? So I go to this place, it's called Nassau County Jail, right? And I wear my NA key tags. I try to look like we call it Goody Two Shoes, or Susie Cream Cheese, we call it, when you never did, look like you never did anything wrong. I had a bow in my fucking hair the whole nine. I look like I was just out of church. So I go to this, I go to the probation officer, and she's not there. So they said, well, you know, Ms. Regas, we're going to have to process the warrant for your arrest. I'm like, okay, now I'm not a jail person, so I don't know the whole jail lingo thing, right? So I go up in front of the judge, and I'm standing there smiling, because I'm sure they're going to let me go. And he says, I didn't even know what this word means. He said, you're remanded. Remanded means they take that big hook, I was going to jail. So with 10 months clean, I went to jail, and when I was lying in my bunk of my jail bunk with 10 months clean, I realized I had tried to make amends. I tried to do a ninth step, but there was one minor flaw. I never worked step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and I did not have a Narcotics Anonymous sponsor. So Melissa, idiot, laying on my bed in Nassau County Jail, thought to myself, maybe I should get a Narcotics Anonymous sponsor. But I always learn that way. I don't usually learn through other people's pain first. I have to feel it for it to mean something to me. So that's when I got a sponsor. And I got somebody that didn't look like me. She was black. I was white. She used different drugs than I did. I was a heroin addict. She was a cokehead, crackhead, what do we call them? And I met my best friend, And we started the journey of life. Was it the road to freedom is the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Now, yesterday I spoke on the 12 traditions, which are vitally just as important, but I want to talk about the 12 steps. And this is what she told me. She told me the first step, you admit you're lost. The second step, someone hands you a map. The third step, you make a decision to use that map. The fourth step, through the 10th step, you take that map and you're going to make a journey. And you clean out all the debris along your road so that you can see straight ahead. The 11th step, you thank your higher power for the journey. The 12th step, you take the map, you grab a newcomer by the hand, you put the map in their hand, and you do it all over again. That is how gentle and loving the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous are. And I want to talk about the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. It's long, so I just want to talk about them. The first step, I had to find out what the disease of addiction meant. And I was taught that the spiritual principle, the first step, was honesty. I'm not talking about honesty where I give change back at the supermarket, although I do that. I'm talking about the honesty. You know when you lie to yourself when you were using, I'll only use heroin on Saturdays? Bullshit. And you know that you make yourself believe the own lie. I'm going to call my old girlfriend who I broke up with, and she causes me a lot of pain, but I'm just calling to say hello. Bullshit. All those lies that you tell us, this is about self-honesty and saying that me, Melissa, can't solve the problems. I can't. Now, that sounds like a pretty hopeless thing. It sounds like, well, why even bother? Because I have step two. Step two is about hope. Now, it's funny. In our second step, it says restore to sanity. Now, the word restore, when you take a piece of antique furniture, we say you're going to restore it. Now, how do you restore a piece of furniture? You sand it down, you take the cloth off of it, but you leave the basic framework. Because the basic framework is good stuff and they don't make it like that. That's your basic framework. See, we're not garbage, we're not pieces of shit. Well, that word restore wouldn't be in there. So I'm learning to take off the stuff that I didn't. I believed a lot of illusions my whole life. I believed I was stupid. I believed I was not good enough. Those are illusions. And in Narcotics Anonymous, this sounds like a strange thing to say, you become disillusioned. But that means that all the stuff that I believed about myself, I'm pushing it aside. And when I came to my second step, I told my sponsor, I said, you know what? I don't believe in God. I don't know what God means. She said, where do you see God in that step? It doesn't talk about, it talks about a power greater than yourself. That one I could do. I could believe that when I came to a meeting and I felt really lousy, for some reason, I felt better when I left. I believe that when I take a walk along the beach, it clears my soul and it makes me feel better. I believe that when I listen to a beautiful piece of music, it makes me feel okay inside. I believe that when I call my sponsor, I feel good inside. I believe that when I get a hug from another addict, I feel good inside. Those are something bigger than Melissa. It's just something other than Melissa. And what it says in the second step is not that you're going to make me feel better. It just says that I believe those things can make me feel better. My sponsor had a bumper sticker. It says, I came to believe, which means I came to the rooms of NA, I came to, which is an expression meaning like I woke up, and then I came to believe. But that's how it worked for me. And that's hope, that you believe that there's stuff that can help you. Step three was about faith. This is where I make a decision to use all those things. And when I said I'd never believed in any kind of God, I found out all those things, the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, someone giving me a big hug, a beautiful piece of music, my son, my husband, a walk on the beach, that's God talking to me. That's how God talks to me. God doesn't talk to me in terms I can't understand. Why would he fucking bother? God wants me to hear him. God wants me to understand him or her or whatever you call your higher power. So God talks to me in very simple, direct terms that I can get in my soul. And that's my faith. And I came to believe that faith is, and I've endured some tragedy in my recovery before, faith is that you know what, you're not gonna get everything explained to you, why things happen, and you believe anyway, and you accept anyway, without saying, well, now I understand why this had to be. Sometimes I'm never gonna understand, but I believe anyway. There's a saying that goes, I believe in the sun, even when it's not shining. So that means when things aren't going right for me, do I say, I don't believe you, God, how could you fucking do this to me? I believe in my higher power, even when it's not going the way Melissa thinks it should go. That's faith. And I moved on to step four. Step four is about courage. You know something? It takes a lot of courage. You know, and you know when you're all writing. And I want to quote something from It Works How and Why first. It says that We have found as a fellowship that those do not work this step will use. It doesn't say might use, could use. It says you will relapse if you don't work that step. So get a guide, whatever you have to do to write, and start writing about. I wrote about by Melissa for Melissa. And it was very painful to write about those things because it was like I was right back in the moment when it was happening. All the shitty fucking things I've done to people. It was like I was happening again and I was humiliated and I was embarrassed. And I had to even do things like take an inventory of my assets. That was so hard for me to say nice things about myself. And I went to my sponsor and she said, listen, you wrote down, for instance, that you were judgmental. Am I judgmental all the time? No. I had no problem writing that about myself. Now, when I would write that I'm kind, I would say, yeah, but I'm not kind. I called that woman a bitch yesterday. I'd cross that one right off. She'd say, but Melissa, you're not kind 24/7 either. You're not kind all the time. Neither are you nor judgmental all the time, but that doesn't mean you're not kind. It's part of what makes up Melissa. So the next part was to move up to step 5, which is about trust. And you know something? I love my sponsor. My sponsor, instead of like making it this big, huge thing, lighting candles and having tissues out for me to cry, I went to her house and she was cooking. And I sat in her kitchen and I felt like I was just talking to a friend. Now there's many ways to do this step. I'm not saying anything's wrong with that. I'm saying I needed to feel comfortable. And when I shared things with her, she didn't bat an eye. And I knew that, this is the trust part, I knew her husband wouldn't be looking at me funny the next week. You know what I mean? You know, you think she's gonna tell, guess what Melissa did? I knew she wasn't gonna tell him anything. And I knew that she loved me. You know, the first tradition in Narcotics Anonymous says, we love and respect each other, not in spite of who we are, but because of who we are. So I knew she loved me, not because in spite of all the things I did. Well, I love you anyway. She loved me because I did those things. Because I did those things. And then I came to step 6, which was about willingness. Willingness to say, you know what, I am no longer under the illusion that fear protects me, that arrogance protects me, that prejudice protects me, that judgment protects me. I'm no longer under the, because I believe those things protected me for a while, my arrogance, when I felt really crappy about myself, that could prop up my low self-esteem and make me feel good at your expense. And willingness means, you know what, this is starting to hurt. And that's what step 4 and 5 show you. This starts to hurt this stuff. It hurts me most of all. Even though I might hurt her feelings, it hurts me 10 times more than it hurts her. And I move on to step 7, which is about humility. And humility means accepting yourself exactly like you are, with your faults, with your assets. But it means that I would wake up in the morning and say a 7-step prayer. God, please let me not gossip at work today. And I would go to work and I would sit down with my cup of coffee and I'd get sucked in. Oh yeah, you know what she said, you know, but one prayer doesn't do it for me. I had to bottom out and feel pain so badly that I had to get on my knees and say, please help me, God. I don't know how to stop. See, step 7 is like step 1. Step 1, we surrender to this big thing called the disease of addiction. You know, we stop using drugs. Step 7, we talk about the attitudes of the disease of addiction. And just like I'm powerless over this big thing called, I'm powerless over the attitudes. And some of them are not going to change. Some of them are going to change this much. Some of them will come back. But I have willingness. And I have to usually go through a lot of pain. Step 8 was about forgiveness. Why forgiveness? Why do we say forgiveness? Because I found out that when I made my list, I really wanted to be forgiven by a lot of people. I was very humiliated. And when I made my list, I was told to make a name and what I did to the person. And it was very painful, actually. It was just as painful as my 4th step. So I made that list, and I found out that I want to be forgiven. I have to be able to do that for other people, too, show mercy. Because it's always about what you did to me, right? And I don't want to forgive you, and I don't want to show you mercy, but please show me mercy when I come to you. And step 9 was where I started to make that amends, restitution. And please, don't sleep on that step. I have to tell you, I have a cousin that I ripped off like crazy. And I always wanted to go make amends to him, but I was so ashamed that I never did it. Come to find out, and this cousin was like a cousin who was like a minister. He like was a preacher, you know, in a church and stuff. So he was like this straight upstanding kind of guy. Come to find out, he I guess he was just like me, because he ended up smoking crack for 5 days and he had a heart attack and died. So I missed my opportunity to help him to make amends. And I live with that. The 10th step is about taking a daily inventory, and it's called perseverance as a spiritual principle. Because, you know, just when I think I'm done with this shit, there's more work to done. Oh, shit, I'm not done. I have to take a daily inventory. But something starts to happen. I start to grow up and become a mature, responsible, loving, kind, caring woman. The 11th step is about meditation. In Narcotics Anonymous, we don't have a formal way to meditate. We don't believe in a formal way of telling people to meditate, anything like that. But we suggest that you go out and start learning. And I have to tell you, one of the best ways is just to pick up the Just for Today book. Start with that. That's a meditation book, whatever meditation book. Pick up a meditation book and start reading. And the 12th step is about service. And this is where you get it all back. And I was saying yesterday that a lot of people think that they come to Narcotics Anonymous and you start to get a little clean time and you say, you know what, I need something more than NA. I don't get anything from NA. Somebody was telling me, it was Lonnie yesterday, that somebody was telling me that the meetings here are very noisy. But if I don't stay here, who's going to teach anybody? So we have to stay. We need your help. We need your help. My gratitude speaks when I care and share with others the NA way, and I said this yesterday, I came to receive and I stay to give. And I said my clean time wrong yesterday, I said it was 87. My clean date is July 13th, 1988, and I still make meetings, and I still do service, and I still have a sponsor, and I still write steps, and I still raise my hand, and I still talk to people on the phone, and I still sponsor people. I don't want to go back and stand on a line and have a 13-year-old kid tell me. They used to say, no shorts, no singles. And what that means is, when you're standing on line to buy heroin, shut up. We don't want to sing any single dollar bills. You better have a $10 bill. And they had a baseball bat that they would whack in their hands. And I was a good soldier. I listened. And then when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, you guys can't tell me anything. And it's funny, I would go into abandoned buildings and they would drop a bucket out of the third floor window. And they would, you put your money in it and the bucket would go back up and you'd pray to fucking God that you got a thing of heroin. But I believed I would. I believed I would. I had total faith that that bag came back and it would be everything that I wanted for and more. So I stay here in Narcotics Anonymous because I believe what you guys tell me, that if I stop doing any of those things, I'm going to relapse. So I stay here. I found out about the 12 traditions in Narcotics Anonymous. And I talked about the 12 traditions yesterday, and I want to touch on them very quickly again. I'm not going to go through all 12 traditions, but I want to just say in 1953, Jimmy Kay started Narcotics Anonymous in California. There was no Narcotics Anonymous. We went to a different fellowship, and they said that we couldn't talk about who we are in that fellowship. And I have no bitterness against that fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous, none at all. Because if they didn't do what they did and say, listen, you can't share about this, we wouldn't be sitting here today. So they made us start our own fellowship. That's cool. So out of the respect for people like Jimmy Kay and all those people that worked really hard so that I could sit in New York, do you know I have 2,500 meetings in the state of New York? That's a lot of meetings, man. So I'm very spoiled by some pioneers who started Narcotics Anonymous for us. And you know something? If you all want to come to California next year, they're having a celebration of Narcotics Anonymous' 50th birthday. It is unbelievable to see people from all over the world descend and celebrate Narcotics Anonymous. To hear the, for me, just hearing the 12 traditions read in Danish, or we were praying in Swedish or Norwegian yesterday. When you hear Japanese and French, and it is a very powerful statement. So save your krona and get together, because it is worth to travel just to see the message of Narcotics Anonymous. I learned about God in Narcotics Anonymous, a higher power, and this is really important. I want to talk about. I want to tell a couple of stories. I never believed in God. I have a younger brother who is retarded. He's brain damaged. So I never believed that God could be so cruel to create somebody like that. And my whole life I avoided my brother. I felt very responsible for him, and yet I was very ashamed of him at the same time. So years go by. My brother lives in an institution about 3 hours north of me, very far away. So here I am, riddled with guilt that I can't go see him. And I call my sisters. Now, I'm clean over 13 years. It took me 13 years to call my sister and say, Christine, why don't we try to move him down near us? Why don't we just make a fuss? She goes, oh, there's a 5-year waiting list to do that. I said, and this is recovery thinking. I say, yeah, but if we make the call, he'll be on the list. So maybe 5 years from now, at least he can come down here and we can see him and we can have him as part of our lives. So I said, you know what? I'm going to do it. See, Narcotics Anonymous, we learn, is a program of action. We do stuff. We don't just talk it. So Monday morning, I make a phone call. And I call, and my whole life I felt like I've had to take care of my brother. And I call this facility in my area where I'm from. And I say, can you tell me how you would remove, how would you move a retarded person from this state to here? How would I go about doing that? And she says, oh, it's funny that you called today. We have a bed available today. Yeah, exactly, because that was God. And I said, well, what's your name? So I took it down. She says, my name is Angel. See, I believe like God talks to me in small ways like that. A couple of months ago, I was on the phone with one of the women that I sponsor. And the next thing I know, I woke up, I was under my table. I don't know how I got there. I had a huge black and blue mark on my face. They said it was either my heart or my brain. They never really found out what it was. But while I was on the phone with her, she called the police. She knew something. She didn't hear me talking anymore. And she heard me like going, moaning. She was, Melissa, Melissa. So she got on the other phone and she called the police and she told them to come to my house. But here's the funny thing. You know why she called me that morning? She called me that morning to get my address to send me an invitation to a party. And you know what she was able to tell the police? My address. See, things, and I've sponsored this woman for like 8 years. Why 8 years, the day that I fall, that I need help to send an ambulance? Is that the day that she could? See, I don't believe in coincidences. So I believe that my higher power loves me incredibly. And I want to talk about that there is absolutely no reason to use. And I want to talk about something that happened in my recovery. You know, in NA, we say that beyond your wildest dreams. We also believe that you should share what's ever going on in your life. It's really important that we talk about the real deal because we need to let the newcomer know, guess what? Life is going to continue to happen and you don't fucking use. I told you that I was married to a man, and he was a wonderful human being. It was one of those cases that my marriage actually worked out. He was 220 pounds, big, big guy. He was a convict. He did a lot of time in the penitentiary, 22 years in the penitentiary. So he wasn't a nice guy out when he was using. He was 19 years older than me. He was 55 years old. And he also had AIDS. Now, my worst nightmare was that my husband, Billy, would die of AIDS. I thought to myself, what would be the one thing, and I don't know if any of you ever thought this, what would be the one thing that would make me use? The one thing, would it be my child dying? Would it be losing this? Would it be this? Would it be that? The one thing. And I always thought that would be the one thing that would make me use was Billy dying. So I'm married to him for 7 years, and I noticed that Billy started walking funny and talking, to me it was funny. He would fall asleep sometimes in the middle of my conversation, but I'm his wife, so maybe he just didn't want to hear what the hell I had to say, right? So I called his job and I said, does Billy seem to be acting strange to you? Oh, no, no, he's fine, he's fine. So Billy's worst nightmare, he was a convict, did a lot of time in the penitentiary, like I said, his worst nightmare, that he was going to be carried out of the back of some penitentiary and buried in some grave with nobody there, you know, nobody knowing him. And I took him to the doctor on December 4th in 1995 because I said, listen, Bill, you got to go to the doctor. He couldn't put his coat on. Now, my worst fear was not only that he would die of AIDS, but die more specifically of something called dementia, which is where the AIDS virus actually eats your brain. And I took him to the hospital on December 4th, and they said, Melissa, there's nothing we can do. He's going to die. And he died on January 17th in 1996, 1 month later. But here's the miracle of Narcotics Anonymous. You know what I was saying before, and I've told this story hundreds of times, and I get overwhelmed every single time I tell it, and I don't get overwhelmed because my husband died. Because I accept that that's where I believe. My husband was a terrible human being when he was active, and I believe when he balanced out in his 9 years of recovery, of living right and helping people, when it became even with his higher power, it was his time to go. That's not such a bad thing. The miracle of Narcotics Anonymous is that if you have money, you have two choices. You can put it in a bank account and it gains interest, right? Your money makes money for you. Or you can take it like my little old Greek grandmother used to do and stick it underneath the pillow. That was a very Mediterranean thing. You stick it under the pillow and hide it. If you take that money out a year later, you're going to still have the same amount of money when you take it out of that pillow. If you take it out of the bank, you have a little extra money. You know what your bank is? It's called making an investment in your recovery. You make meetings, you do service, you have sponsor, you raise your hand, you tell us who you are, you let us love you, you love us back. That's an investment in Narcotics Anonymous. And Billy and I made good investments all these years. See, I get a big payback for all this stuff. I don't do it because I just want to stay clean and stuff. I get a big payback. I'm selfish too. I love being loved. Now here's the payback. We're called crackheads, dope fiends. I have no illusions about who I sit next to in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I don't think you're all like praying over Bibles when you go home. I have no illusions who I sit next to. I know some have robbed, cheaters, liars, thieves, prostitutes, murderers, people who have molested children. I have no illusions about who I sit next to in a meeting. None. They're my best friends. Because you know who showed up and took care of my husband and helped him die? Because Billy's request to me is, he grew up his whole life in an institution. He was locked behind bars his whole life, half of his life. He said, please let me, he used to call me Mo. Mo, please let me die at home. Now, when my father died of cancer, you know what I did? I took his morphine and I crushed it up and I shot it into my arm. The loving daughter. So here is my opportunity to finally keep my word to somebody. Finally, really show up. Not just because he was my husband, but because he was my best friend. You know who came over my house every day? The crackheads, the dope fiends, the prostitutes, the burglars. Every day, members of Narcotics Anonymous showed up my house. And you changed his diaper, because he had to wear a diaper. And you washed his hair. And you fed him with love and kindness and caring. The night that my husband died, I took him to the hospital and I said to the doctor, listen, do me a favor. If he's going to die, please release him to me because he wants to die at home. And he said, don't worry, I'm going to do that, Melissa. He died the way he wanted to die. That's what the doctor said. My husband was not a believer in a lot of medication, so he said he lived the way he wanted to live, he should die the way he wants to die. So when I took him to the hospital, he said, Melissa, there's nothing we can do, he's going to die tonight. And I brought him home, and you know how we talk about gossip in Narcotics Anonymous, but it works two ways. We call it a hotline, right? One person calls another person. When I came home to my apartment, there were about 15 addicts sitting outside my door, waiting for me to come home because they heard about Billy. And we all carried him in, and we laid him on the bed. And, you know, I'm a very selfish person. I wanted my husband all to myself for the last hour that he was alive. But he didn't belong to me. He belonged to you. You made him the person that he was. You made him that by loving him, by caring for him. And I don't mean just when he was dying. I mean, you made him the person he was for 9 years. So I had to let one by one all those people go in, and they each said goodbye to him. And it was my turn to go in, and addicts are such cool people. They had put all kinds of, you know, here's my clean time coin. We have a coin, you know the eternity sign that it's a sideways figure eight? We actually have lost so many people in Narcotics Anonymous that we had to come up with an eternity clean time coin from losing so many members. And yeah. And when I came into the room, he had like eternity coins on his chest. Someone put like a little medallion, number one sponsor. People put little prayers for him. It was all over his chest. And trust me, I don't mean to sound cruel, but my husband was a vegetable at this point. He was not even slightly present. And something extremely magical happened. What a powerful thing addicts are. We are about so much more than Melissa Dutch just not shooting dope. What happened was we knew he was dying, and we like picked up his arms. He was laying in the bed, and we just very naturally made the circle of Narcotics Anonymous. And he died while we said the Serenity Prayer. What a gift I could give him. What a gift we gave him. His worst fear, being carried out the back gate of a jail or a prison, didn't come true. That he moved on in a circle of love, of people who knew him better. They didn't care that he went to jail. They didn't care the things he did, because they did him too. And what happened at his funeral, 6 people from his family showed up, and 300 members of Narcotics Anonymous showed up. 300 of you. Yeah. You know, you clap for yourselves when you do that. You clap for yourselves because you gave me that gift. And the funny thing was, it wasn't this big sad thing. I'm crying, but it wasn't this big sad thing. People sang songs. Addicts are great people. We love to perform. We're big hams. We call it a ham. You know, love to get up and so people told stories about my husband. They sang songs. They read poetry. They read things out of the basic text. And what we did was we celebrated this man's life. We celebrated his life. And when I woke up on Friday morning, I could hear the clock ticking. And for all those of you who have survived death, the only thing I could say about death, loss is a motherfucker. Let me tell you something. It is a bitch. You think that you're fine one day, you'll be walking down the street 6 months, and all of a sudden it slaps you in the face, and you have a day of grief. And I don't care if it's your parent, your wife, your husband, your child. Grief is a difficult thing to get through. But I want to tell you, you do get through it. You know, I have little scars on my body. It's another little scars, but scars are a little tough. It's okay. I have another reference point in my recovery. I have to tell you, I don't think like that anymore. What would be the one thing I would use over? Nothing. Because I survived. So when I woke up Saturday morning, I heard the clock ticking. I was like, now what am I going to do? The funeral was done. You know, I called my sponsor. She said, you're going to make a meeting. See, nothing changed. So I got up, and when I had, it was 7 years clean at this point, I made 90 meetings in 90 days. Because I didn't know what else to do with myself. And I took a service commitment because I didn't know what else to do for myself. Because I felt like jumping off a roof. I didn't feel like shooting dope, trust me. Because I thought to myself, wait a minute, I didn't use for all this time I had my wonderful husband alive, and now that I'm going to use heroin to replace him? So I'm saying that heroin is the same thing as having my husband? Not even close. So I didn't want to use, but I wanted to die. And the bottom line is, I did all the things I was suggested, and here's the miracle, I'm still here. I haven't used. And that's what I was talking about, faith, before. That, guess what, it will never be explained to me why that particular thing happened in my life, but I know it was supposed to happen. And here I am in Denmark, okay, it's many years later, and I'm married to my best friend over there, because you see, you don't know what God has in store for you. And I have a little 2-year-old boy. Let me tell you, I'm 43 years old. I turned 41 the month after I had him. And that little boy teaches me so much about life. You know, when I started going out with my husband, a lot of people got pissed off at me. There was a lot of judgment. You know, addicts, with this black and white of addiction. We love you, Melissa. We got through Billy's death. Now it's like, you fuck, how could you go out with somebody after you know. Black and white of addiction. And it's all right. It's okay. But I was the one walking around with the resentment. Me. And I want to tell a little story, that there's these two monks or priests, and they both took a vow of silence. They said, you know, with their brotherhood, they said, we don't speak to anybody outside, we can only speak to each other, and we never will touch a woman. Never touch a woman. So the two brothers, they're walking down the road, the two priests are walking down the road, and they see this old woman, and she's trying to cross a river. And she says, excuse me, Father, could you please help me across the river? I'm too weak to cross it. I'll drown. And he says, of course, my lady. And he picks her up, and he carries her across the river. The other priest looks at him like, you just broke your vow. He's like furious at him. So they cross the river. The priest puts the woman down on the other side. And she says, thank you, sir. I need to get home to my family. Thank you so much. And he says, no problem. So the two priests continue down the road. The one priest that carried the woman, he's pretty happy. He's pretty content. He's not saying anything. And the other priest is fuming. He's pissed off. He's angry. He doesn't understand how he could do that. He's resentful. So finally, he breaks his silence. He says to the other priest, how could you do that? You're not supposed to touch another woman. You're not supposed to talk to anybody else. How could you carry her across the river like that? And he said, my brother, I carried her for 1 minute. You've been carrying her for the last 5 miles. So, heroes, I was resentful, but meanwhile, I just needed to continue with my life and love my husband. Because I have to tell you, there's many different paths. There's no right path in this fellowship. It's Narcotics Anonymous is tailor-made for you. And when you start to judge, and so, you know what the funny thing? Judgment's a funny thing. I judge lots of people until it happens to me. Then it doesn't feel so good. You know, then it's like, so, and my husband shares that. But all this, we built what we call spiritual muscle. Everything that I've gone to has built spiritual muscle. And now we're married, and believe me, we're a typical couple. We argue, we fight, but he's my best friend. I don't want to spend my life with anybody else but him and our beautiful little boy. There's a saying that when you make a decision to have a child, you make a decision to have your heart walk around on the outside of your body for the rest of your life. It really is true. The women know what I'm talking about. The men know what I'm talking about who have kids. That's my little heart. And everything that happens to him, it's like, it's happening to me. Because I love him so much. But that little boy teaches me much more about them being a parent. I learn more about character defects through sponsorship, through service, and through being a mother, and through being a wife. Trust me. I'm going to tell another little story, what this little boy teaches me. There's a mommy who's about to have a baby. And she already has a little girl, a five-year-old little girl. And the little girl is very obsessed with this baby. She says, Mommy, leave me alone with the baby when the baby comes home. I want to be alone with the baby. So the mother's a little concerned about this because she knows bigger brothers or sisters can hurt little babies. So they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, it's okay. Just leave her in there with the baby. And they have a monitor, the little monitor that you can hear. She says, turn on the monitor, stand outside the door, and listen to what she does with the baby. If she hurts the baby, you run right in. So finally, the big day comes. Mommy has the baby. And they all come home, and she says, here's your baby brother. And the little girl says, oh, leave me alone with the baby. Leave me alone with the baby. So they put the baby in the room. They put the little girl in the room, and they listen at the door. And they hear the little girl say to the baby, can you teach me about God? Because I'm starting to forget. That little boy is so connected. See, I forgot. I forgot all the things that I believed to be true when I was a kid, being happy, being joyous, being free. And Narcotics Anonymous has given it all back to me. You know something? Childish is not cool. Childlike, it's right on the money. As I'm getting older, and I was saying this yesterday, you know how much you have to learn to realize that you don't know any fucking thing. I have so much to learn. Poor Jack, I asked him every single question about your country because there's so much I want to see. There's so much I want to learn about everything because I found out that I don't know very much. And I want to be, we're connected. We are very connected. It's not just me sitting here. Narcotics Anonymous works from one heart, going to another heart, going to another heart, going to another. It is extremely powerful, profound experience. So when I say we need you to stay, we need you to stay. I want to thank everybody, my addict brothers and sisters, for making me feel so welcome. Jack gave up his apartment, his bachelor pad, for 1 week. So we know all of Jack's deep, dirty secrets, and I'll be happy to tell you after the meeting. Seriously, for everybody that's been willing just to sit and talk with us, for Jack's father, for giving us a car for 3 days so I could be a tourist and go see Kronborg Castle and drag every poor Jack around. I've had a wonderful time when I'm here, and my husband and my little boy too, for giving us your love and your support. And I hope I see you in New York. If you do, you got a place to stay. And that's funny. You may think that's stupid, but I mean that. That's how Narcotics Anonymous works. We are family. You know, I could look at somebody that's black and say, they don't look like me, but we're very closely related. So my name is Melissa. Thank you so much for letting me share.